Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, everybody. Cheryl Akison here. Welcome to another edition of Full Measure After Hours. Today, a deep look at controversies surrounding one of the most widely prescribed drugs in America that you may not have heard of, gabapentin. On Sunday, December 4th, I'm going to have a really interesting look at a widely prescribed drug called gabapentin. What's so interesting about it? Well, a few things. One of them is the wide number of maladies that doctors are prescribing it for. Nerve disorders, pain, sort of unspecified pain, anxiety. And almost all of its use is for things that the FDA never approved it for. Now, it's perfectly legal for doctors to prescribe drugs like gabapentin for so-called off-label use, something the FDA didn't approve it for, to try it on their patients for things other than what it was tested and supposedly proven to treat. But this drug really stands out for the fact that so little of it is actually used for its originally intended and approved purpose. Gabapentin kind of picked up steam as a popular drug pretty fast. I started hearing about people being on it for all kinds of things, and then I went to the vet and they were trying to give it to my dog too. Also interesting, the debate over whether it's addictive. Sunday on Full Measure, you're going to hear a really heart-wrenching story from a musician who had kicked his crack cocaine addiction years before, was prescribed gabapentin for anxiety, and he got hooked on it just like crack. Eventually, he said he was taking 25 or more of these pills a night and then having withdrawals when he tried to get off of it, even trying to crush it up and snort it. Now, a lot of people do say still that gabapentin is not addictive. It's possible, say some, it could be addictive to some people, but not others. But that dovetails into another issue, its role in the opioid epidemic and opioid deaths. A great number of opioid abusers, it seems, are also abusing gabapentin, and you're going to hear more about that in my interviews today. My first interview is with Michael Abrams. He is a senior health researcher with Public Citizens Health Research Group. This group has submitted a petition to more strictly regulate gabapentin.
So, gabapentin is a widely used medication in the United States, in the world. To give you some idea of the magnitude that we're talking about, I was just looking at some data. There's something like 200 million encounters, medical encounters every year that involve gabapentin every year, just in the United States, something like 64 million plus prescriptions. So we're talking about a lot of medicine. It's used principally when it was originally approved in 1993. The singular indication was to treat a certain kind of seizure disorder that affects just one hemisphere of the brain, partial onset seizures. Since that time, it's been FDA approved, that is demonstrated at least to the FDA that it was safe and effective for other indications that include post-traumatic neuralgia, which is the rash that you get if you get the shingles infection. And it's also approved for some other neurologic pain syndromes. It's very closely related to another drug called pregabalin. The molecular structure of these two drugs are distinctly similar in terms of molecular weight and the molecules that you see in that. As it turns out, pregabalin, the second drug that I mentioned related to gabapentin, was approved in 2005 for similar indications. And it immediately was placed on the Drug Enforcement Administration's schedule for concerns about it being abused, diverted, and causing harm to human beings, okay, and being used widely by humans. Gabapentin, however, going back to 1993, never was scheduled in that way, and is much more widely used in pregabalin for similar indications. And the petition that we're drafting now is, or that we drafted, is a response to that incongruency and that concern, to bring gabapentin to under the purview of the Drug Enforcement Administration's dominion, if you will, to follow that drug and to make sure that its use continues to be safe for the broader American public.
Okay, a few questions. Medically, what is your gripe, if anything, with gabapentin or the way it's being prescribed?
So if you take a look at the utilization of it in recent years, it has become a situation where it's widely used off-label. And by that, we mean that it's used for indications that are not approved by the FDA, for which the evidence base is poor. In fact, if you take a look at gabapentin data specifically, and you know, look at claims data, for example, or do individual level surveys of prescriptions, and then you try to match up the use of the drug to whether the drug is approved for that, you find that 98.5%, one recent study indicated, so almost virtually all of gabapentin that's being prescribed are for indications that were not approved by the FDA. Okay, that's of great concern to us because there are both safety and efficacy, right, whether or not the medicine works, concerns that convey when you prescribe a medication for a use that it wasn't approved for originally.
What does that tell you? So an off-label use means, I think, a doctor can decide on his own that even though it's not approved for this use, it may help a particular patient. He has some experience with it. But when so many doctors are prescribing this drug for so many off-label uses, does that mean perhaps it's been marketed kind of behind closed doors for these other things? Or what do you take away from that?
So, you know, there's good and bad reasons why off-label use happens. Sometimes medical practice discovers that there are indications that weren't originally evident when a drug was approved that could be efficacious. Other times, it's, as you suggest, that there's, you know, promotion, inappropriate promotion, or by the industry, right? It's an industry's interest to sell more units of their medication than with time as much as possible. The FDA is pretty good at policing that kind of latter activity, and there have been some changes in over time to encourage the FDA and industry to not, you know, promote drugs surreptitiously in the way that you're suggesting. I think what we're talking about here with gabapentin is, since a lot of its off-label use are for indications that are very difficult to treat, substance use disorder, for example, pain syndromes, for example, for which treatments are wanting, often not good, or if we take a look at, you know, pain syndromes, for example, we know over the last 20 years that while opioids control acute pain very well, for chronic pain, bad things happen. In fact, really bad things happen. People take too much of their opioid. They're breathing slow, sometimes so much so that they stop breathing and they die, right? Thus, the opioid overdose epidemic. The desire to try to quell human pain, right, is a fairly straightforward one in medicine. And the idea, even if it's not supported then by good clinical evidence, that you have a medication that acts in the brain, acts on nerves, and can ease otherwise unexplained pain from things like fibromyalgia, for example, or postherpetic neuralgia related to the shingles, as I described earlier, is very compelling. And some of those indications have been tested. The postherpetic neuralgia, for example, has been. Fibromyalgia is only approved indication for gabapentin. Sorry, for pregabalin, not for gabapentin. So it's somewhat natural that a doctor might say, ah, let's try gabapentin for this pain syndrome, whatever might be the original cause of it. And it's become just so widespread that you see people using it for a lot of things. I mean, it's used for hiccups, a variety of different ailments, post-surgical pain control, for which the evidence base is very poor. It's been used for a lot of these sort of related syndromes to the original indication, and doctors have found it to be an easy thing for them to try to do something to help their patient in front of them. And I think that's why we're at the place that we're at.
That makes sense. What is the downside of that? What is the downside to an individual patient or society for a potential over-prescribing of a medicine that may not work for some of these things?
Yeah, so the simple story is that the downside is are the risks associated with the medication. There are two. The risks being the key one. You know, if we take a look at data, recent data, again, linking it to the opioid epidemic is completely reasonable here, because what we're talking about, the principal risk that we're concerned about and that we're targeting with our petition is the risk of overdose and potential respiratory failure and death, right? With opioids, it's clear that that's part of the story. It's clear also, even as things started to get a little bit under control before COVID, now the opioid epidemic is resurging. Over 100,000 overdose deaths overall, probably 70-80% of them tied to opioids. There are other substances cause overdose too, alcohol and so forth. But opioids have been a principal driver of this. So how does this relate to gabapentin? Okay, it turns out that gabapentin is also a respiratory depressant. And it's used to treat pain. So it's would be perfectly imaginable for a clinician to say, oh, let's try a little bit of opioid and let's try a little bit of gabapentin. As it turns out, there's very good qualitative research and more detailed scientific research, quantitative research, that indicates that gabapentin sort of potentiates or promotes the respiratory depression effect of opioids. Combine them together, you're posing an added risk on people that they might not even be aware of. If one doctor is prescribing the gabapentin, for example, and another doctor is prescribing the opioid, that's possible. Maybe the doctor that's prescribing both is aware, but the patient isn't as aware as they could be. We also see that substance abusers are aware of the fact that they can sort of upregulate their response to opioids by using gabapentin. So it's become a way to sort of enhance their high, if you will. And there's good qualitative and quantitative data to support that concern as well. But so really the key thing is that we're trying to mitigate this risk of respiratory depression and death. If you take a look at, there's been a couple of recent studies that have cataloged what percentage of these opioid deaths we should be thinking about with regard to gabapentin. And it's something on the order of 5-10% from recent, broad national studies looking at how often you detect gabapentin in, say, a decedent, an overdose decedent.
That's
that
a
you
lot.
Detected. And yeah, that's a lot. And especially if you consider how difficult it's been for us to get a handle on the opioid overdose epidemic, right? Why would we want to ignore the possibility that there's this factor that's contributing 5-10% of the risk here potentially?
And so in theory, though, opioid users, even if they're illicit opioid users, are somehow getting a doctor's prescription for gabapentin? Or is this for sale on the black market, as far as you know?
So there's evidence certainly of widespread prescription use. I think if you were sort of to take a look at abusers, as some of the data that I saw recently, if you take a look at people who abuse the substance, they're taking higher doses than they should be, or somehow are using it for recreational purposes or for purposes that aren't purely medical, 65% roughly of them got their original prescription from a doctor, okay? So then the other 35% or so is somehow being diverted, and there are, you know, qualitative reports from different populations that suggest there's a street value to this, $10 a pill or whatever, and there's that kind of diversion, or that people might crush the pill and snort it as opposed to taking, you know, the tablet orally. So there's certainly evidence of pure diversion that doesn't a person doesn't obtain it from a doctor. But most of it is coming from, you know, widespread prescriptions. As I said, 64 million prescriptions. I think that's 2016 data. So that's probably 80 million today easily. It's something like the seventh most prescribed medication that's out there, prescription medication that's out there. So widely available.
More from Michael Abrams in just a moment as he explains what scheduling of a drug means in the context of federal regulation.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Sure. So the Drug Enforcement Administration has what they call scheduling, which basically rank orders substances on their abuse potential and the risk that they pose to human health overall based on that. And it goes from one, which are the most dangerous drugs, and things on Schedule One are things like heroin and cocaine, stuff that's illegal. And then two through four are potentially legal substances. By the way, Schedule One also includes marijuana. That's an interesting thing to think about in today's world. But overall, Schedule One drugs are illegal and not available for human use. Schedule Two through Five are rank ordered in terms of their from two being the highest risk, things like morphine, OxyContin, and drugs, you know, serious opioid drugs like that are very common on Schedule Two. And then three through five are less addictive substances, less pernicious substances to human health. Our petition specifically aims to place gabapentin along with pregabalin, the other related drug I mentioned, which is already on Schedule Five, to place gabapentin on Schedule Five. So the lowest level and the lowest risk that the Drug Enforcement Administration concerns itself with, but still, for something to be placed on that list, it has to have some abuse concern and human health concern potential.
What would that do in practice if gabapentin is placed on Schedule 5?
Yeah, so it principally would do two things. It would require that anybody who prescribes gabapentin has to be licensed with the Drug Enforcement Administration to handle a controlled substance. So that means any doctor who already is prescribing opioids, for example, would be able to easily prescribe gabapentin, no big change there. Doctors who were not prescribing pain medicine, that would be a change for them. Then the other thing that it would require is it would require manufacturers, pharmacists, the doctors themselves to record the number of pills that they were dispensing and clearly label things for the patient to see on the bottle that they were getting a controlled substance and, you know, would up, if you will, the cautions that should anyways convey with a prescription, even if it doesn't involve a controlled substance. But in this case, it would up that intensity. One thing that it wouldn't do, although this was done in the UK in 2019 with both pregabalin and gabapentin, is it wouldn't require any limits on the duration of prescriptions or the number of prescriptions that could be issued. And that's something that we think the DEA actually should think about when they do place it on the schedule, because that would be a good thing, we think, although since we're aiming for level 5, it wouldn't be mandatory. But simply stated, the idea that you would, every 6 months at least, for example, need to go back to your doctor and say, hey, I want to refill this, and the doctor should ask you some things about how you're doing with your medicines. Are you taking any other medicines? How's your health status overall? Maybe we should taper you on your medication. That's the idea behind the higher schedules, 4 to 2. There are specific provisions in there that say every certain period of time you need to circle back with your doctor to get your prescription renewed, or your prescription will expire after 6 months. We're not calling for that here, although we think the DEA actually should think about it once it hits the schedule nevertheless. So.
To be clear, you're not saying gabapentin is a bad drug.
Correct. We're not suggesting a ban. In fact, it's a fairly cautious action, which mostly is one that requires better record keeping vis-a-vis the drug and a little bit more licensing requirement for the prescriber. But again, like I say, imagine you have a pain syndrome and you go to a doctor and that doctor doesn't have a license to prescribe narcotics. That would be a little bit unusual, quite frankly. It's still possible. But if they did and they were already thinking opioids might be one of the things I might use for severe pain or acute pain, then they already have the license, which is what this scheduling on Schedule 5 would require. So in some ways, it's a fairly tiny change that we're suggesting, but we think it's an important one, mostly because it gets the word out, if you will, to clinicians and then to their patients that this is a substance that should not be taken lightly in terms of its addictive risk potential, in terms of sort of the neurologic sequelae that might go along with using it, make you dizzy, make you sleepy. There could even be rebound effects when you go off it that might involve something as terrible as a seizure, for example. We want to up the intensity and to use the tools that the DEA has at its disposal to encourage better prescribing of this medication, which has we've seen increased greatly, as I said, and for uses that are not evidence-based.
I'm not sure you did describe the spike from the time it came out. I think you said in like 93 or so. Was it at a fairly normal level and then a big spike at some point in time? Or what do you notice in terms of trends?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I'm not sure I can remember that per se. I do know that, so it came out in 93, and folks have asked me, why now, right? So I think that kind of gets to your question. The vigilance on this medication in 93, when it was, it was originally prescribed for seizure disorder, somewhat rare. And then it became approved for postherpetic neuralgia, much more common condition, pain syndrome condition as well, which probably drew attention to it. But if you think about also just sort of the trajectory of the opioid overdose epidemic, it was more in the early 2000s that we saw this. So we're talking about a 10-year lag where gabapentin was, being used to treat seizures, not so much on the radar. Then you approve pregabalin, at the time, then when we started to see also the opioid surge. So that has something to do with the patterns that we're seeing. And part of the issue here, and part of what the petition, why the petition we think is important, and why DEA scheduling is important, is a lot of places that do, you know, a forensic tox on postmortem cases, for example, don't put gabapentin on the list of drugs that they screen for. Certainly, opioids are on there, right? Cocaine and so forth. But so part of it is you have to attend to it. You have to look for the signal. Now that people are looking for the signal, and to answer your question, certainly in the last 10 years, we've seen this this steady increase. So if you look at, you know, early 2000s to 2016, there's lots of publications now and meta-analyses that show the kinds of increases and the concerns that we're talking about. But, you know, now that folks are starting to screen for it, you're seeing, you know, much more signal, which is where the data I described to you, where we're seeing 5 to 10% of overdose deaths that we see involve gabapentin. It was just some data that I looked at from Florida that somebody sent me from Florida. And they, in 19 and 20, saw, no, sorry, in 2020, they saw almost 900 deaths where gabapentin was one of the substances that was found in the blood of the decedents in a one-year period in the state of Florida. So, you know, upscale that to the United States, we're talking thousands of potential decedents that are being exposed to this medication that we know from its pharmacology, from animal studies, from clinical studies, is one of the things that can lead to this respiratory depression effect that kills you, that is driving the opioid overdose epidemic.
Now, an opposing view. We're going to hear from a neurologist, Dr. Brian Callahan, an associate professor of neurology at the University of Michigan. He was involved in the American Academy of Neurology guidelines that he says showed gabapentin is one of the four effective classes of drugs to treat painful diabetic neuropathy, and they also recommended against opioids, seeing that gabapentin could be something that's a better alternative.
Sure. My view on gabapentin is that it's an effective medicine to relieve neuropathic pain. It works a little bit, not a lot, and it has very few side effects. So it's one of our four really good options for nerve pain. And there has been some literature starting to come out that maybe it can make things worse when used without opioids, but those are really in the early stages. So my view is that, you know, we should not have it as a controlled substance.
Is it FDA approved for nerve pain?
That's a good question. It is. I don't know that it is. Pregabalin is FDA approved for nerve pain, but I think the studies for gabapentin were further back, and I don't know that they have an FDA indication.
Could they go back and get that if they wanted to at some point?
Probably.
Okay. What's your view on, you kind of touched on it, but I want to ask a whole separate question. What's your view on the notion that gabapentin should be more controlled?
What's the argument?
What is your view against that? Yes.
Against it, yeah. Well, I think the downsides are, you know, the time it takes the physicians. There's extra hoops that we have to go through. So anytime we prescribe gabapentin, there's multiple layers of extra codes. And then we also have to go through and check to make sure that they're not abusing medication. So there is a non-trivial amount of work. It's not a ton, but when you prescribe it as much as we do, that becomes a big downside. And then number two, I think, is the kind of the false equivalency with some of the other controlled substances. It makes you almost think, maybe I shouldn't be prescribing it this often, when really it's a great alternative to, you know, the other controlled substances like the opioids.
Is gabapentin addictive?
Gabapentin is not addictive that we know of.
And if there are addicts who think it has been addictive for them, is it just sort of a one-off? But how, or anything maybe can be for some people, but it doesn't mean it's an addictive drug? Because we did interview someone who thinks he was an addict. He was given it for anxiety, and he thinks he became an addict again because of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that's, you know, kind of anecdote. I don't know that we have good evidence that would suggest that it's addictive. You know, we have ways of studying addiction. Do people desire it? From a clinician's, a neurologist perspective, you know, I've never had someone coming in, you know, asking for it earlier, asking for more, things that we have all the time with opioids, benzodiazepines, other controlled substances. And that, I think, is also the experience of my colleagues as well.
When we're talking about something that may help with nerve pain, can you help people understand why it would be important to patients to not make it so hard to get?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it affects the patients as much, other than, you know, if you put a barrier for the doctor, they might prescribe it less. If there's that false equivalency, they might prescribe it less. But I don't know that it's that much harder for patients. It's really kind of more on the physician side, and kind of discouraging it to being prescribed.
And I was thinking, though, if a doctor is less likely to prescribe it and you have a patient in a great deal of pain who's not going to use opioids, maybe you've taken a source of comfort away from patients. How common is nerve pain today, sort of this unsolvable pain that some people have?
Oh, goodness. Nerve pain is incredibly common. I study painful diabetic neuropathy. That you know, really affects one out of five people with diabetes. We all know how common diabetes is. But there's so many other types of nerve pain from mononeuropathies like carpal tunnel syndrome, or from pinched nerves in the neck or back. So when you add it all up, nerve pain is incredibly common.
Can you explain that? I guess it's pretty hard to find something that treats nerve pain well. So the idea that if gabapentin does help some people, why that's so important?
Yeah, and that gets back to, you know, we really only have four really good classes of medicines that work, of which the gabapentins are one of them. If you make it hard for one of them, you know, we only have a few other options before some people go to opioids. We recommend against opioids, but sometimes that's where people end up if they don't respond to these.
Public Citizen is an advocacy group that's recommending not drastically tighter controls, just what it describes as a bit more bookkeeping and making sure that doctors who prescribe it have a license they probably already have anyway in most cases. What's your view on that?
My view is that, unfortunately, you know, prescribing it, it's become harder since, you know, I practice in the state of Michigan, where it is one of the states that has it as a controlled substance, and it makes it harder for me to prescribe it. I think if I was less knowledgeable about the subject, I might think that I shouldn't be prescribing it as much, that maybe it is like some of these other medicines like opioids. So I think it has real effects. It's not so dramatic in one case if you only had to do it once, but if you're seeing 15 patients and prescribing it to four of them and then doing it day after day, you know, then it adds up to quite a lot.
But can you describe some of the differences in, since it is scheduled versus if it weren't, in the job that you have to do?
Yeah, so when you have a controlled substance and you prescribe it, we have to generate another note that kind of says that we looked into their prescribing system and making sure that they're not getting it from multiple sources. And then we also have to have a two-layer system where we have, you know, two passwords on the phone and your normal password. So, you know, it's just another layer of work to do that we don't always have time to do.
Okay. Anything else you want to add about it on this topic?
You know, I would just, you know, emphasize that nerve pain is super common, and gabapentin is one of the super, it's effective, and we don't have that many things that are effective. And so I think it's important to have it be available to patients. And I don't think there should be an equivalency with opioids, which are so much different with so many more problems. So I would like to see it, you know, continue to be easy to use and have physicians have that confidence that it really is not an addictive substance.
For more information on the efforts to restrict gabapentin, at least restrict it more than it is today, you can read the petition by Public Citizen at its website. You can go to citizen.org and search gabapentin, G-A-B-A-P-E-N-T-I-N. For more on all of this, I hope you'll watch my TV show Full Measure on December 4th, when we will also hear from that musician, Leo Ashline, what a struggle he had being prescribed gabapentin and becoming addicted to it, pretty much losing the life that he had, that he knew, having to go back into rehab and start all over again. To find out how you can watch Full Measure, you can go to CherylAtkisson.com and click the Full Measure tab. You will find a list of stations and times Plus, it will explain how you can watch on our free app called Stir and how you can watch online, live, or on demand. I hope you'll also think about visiting the Cheryl Atkison store. You can go to CherylAtkison.com and click the store tab. I have some really unique, fun, and interesting holiday products, all kinds of sales going on, with proceeds benefiting independent journalism like the ION Awards for original and off-narrative journalism. Do your own research, make up your own mind, think for yourself.